on, though.
Yeah.
I'd like to call this Labor and Commerce. Well, Labor and Commerce Committee is calling to order. Today is Saturday, May 11th. The time is 3:08 p.m. Thank you all for coming in on a Saturday. Members present are Representative Hannon, Representative Rivak, Representative Fields, Representative Tallarico, Representative Stutes, Representative Story, myself, Chair Wohl. We have a quorum to conduct business. We also have staffing us today, Ashley Stroud, committee aide, Sophia Tenney, Labor and Commerce Secretary, and Nate Williams, the LIO moderator. So we have two bills on the agenda today, SB 16 and SB 83. Senator Machicki's carrying SB 16 and Senator Birch carrying SB 83. We have amendments on both of those bills. And our first item is SB 16, and we have some amendments for that bill today. Are there any questions or comments from the committee before we get going? Seeing and hearing none, are there any amendments to be offered?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tallarico.
Move amendment number one.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. And do I have it in front of me? Ashley, I'll make sure I get my own. I got it. And we have on the line Erica McConnell from the AMCO office and Jerome Hertel from Alaska State Fair. Amendment number one, Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what amendment number one would do would be reinsert the music festival permit with some stipulations. And I appreciate several of the members helping out with this with some good ideas. One of the stipulations would be the permit could not exceed four calendar days. The music festival would, this is a grandfathered process. It would have to exist in the previous 10 years before the application was filed, and the board would not be able to issue more than one music festival permit, I'm sorry, to the holder of a restaurant or eating place license in a calendar year. It would only be one. Can't be transferred or renewed. That's kind of the gist of amendment number one, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any discussion? I guess this musical festival permit was on the original, on the CS. No, it wasn't on the CS. It was on the bill before it came to this committee, and it was taken off. And after talking to many people, I felt that music festivals currently exist using a catering permit with a BDL, and for remote festivals or events such as Arctic Man, which I'm not sure is that District 6. I don't know. Paxson Lake. And also Anderson Bluegrass Festival, I think, which is definitely in District 6. Mm-hmm. And that there are no, a restaurant eating place license is a license given to a restaurant to allow them to serve beer and wine with a meal to be consumed at the restaurant, and that also restricts them to 50%, at least 50% of their sales is food. So giving a restaurant license, REPL as it's called, a music festival where there could be many hundreds or over 1,000 people or more, I don't know how many go to this. I think we're talking about Chicken Stock is the festival you have in mind, Representative Tallarico?
Mr. Chair, that's right. Yeah, and I think probably the biggest difficulty is the precedence that was set for 7 or 8 years when they were actually given a permit, right, to operate, and then because of a change in personnel, suddenly we established a precedence for 7 or 8 years and provided these people a permit, and then suddenly the permit that they've been accustomed to being issued isn't available to them anymore.
I think they were able to have a festival using their REPL, which was incorrectly applied. I don't know if it was a change in personnel, and Erica McConnell's on the line. I think this change happened before she came on board, mm-hmm, and I will verify that, how many years they operated with an REPL. They have been operating with a BDL for many years. I Do you know how many that is?
I believe three, possibly four.
So several years with the BDL. So I don't think the festival has stopped functioning. Erica McConnell, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is Erica McConnell.
Can you speak to, do you know when the, we're talking about Chicken Stock, the music festival in Chicken, Alaska. Do you know when it went from using an REPL and started using a BDL for their permitting for their concert?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that happened in 2016.
And thank you, Ms. McConnell. Was that before you came on board at the AMCO office?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So 16, what's it now, 19?
19.
So 16, 17, 18. So it sounds like they've operated 3 years on a BDL. I guess, Representative Hannon.
It would be two, because they wouldn't have had Chicken Stock in 2019 yet. Summer
16, 17, 18. I don't know when in 16 it happened, so anyhow, at least two, maybe three. I guess my hesitancy is, and you narrowed the scope, which I appreciate, so it's not open to the almost 400 REPLs that exist in the state. I have a problem sort of making a carve-out for one particular business that happens to be in your district. I understand it happens all the time, so. And seeing as they've been functioning using a BDL, as does Arctic Man and other similar type events that have music and sell alcohol, I don't necessarily see the need for the exemption, the carve out. So, you know, I'm going to maintain my objection. Representative Fields.
I think Representative Stutz was first, actually.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't necessarily disagree with what you have said, Mr. Chair, or with what the representative to my right has said, except for one thing. Chicken isn't exactly in the center of Anchorage or anything, and I understand that they could have a catering permit off a BDL, but there's only one BDL in Chicken, and if this restaurant owner isn't on good terms with that individual, well, that lets them out. Having had a BDL license myself, there's a lot of liability that goes along with having your license used for a caterer's permit. And I know that it's been said, you know, the guy from Fairbanks allows his license to be used. He's there. Wherever the BDL license comes from, you have to have somebody from that license at the event the whole time. And I just think it makes it so onerous. And then I add to it the idea that this is a little community in the middle of nowhere looking to have one event a year for the people that come. And so ordinarily, I would agree wholeheartedly with you, Mr. Chair, but since it's narrowed down so much, and I really like the fact that this permit cannot be transferred or sold, I think that narrows it down even more. That so whoever that has the restaurant, if they are granted this permit, if they sell the restaurant, that's the end of Chicken Stock unless they make other arrangements. So I guess I'm leaning towards voting in a positive manner.
Representative Fields, in just 1 second, I just want to, you said that's the end of Chicken Stock, but they're using a BDL currently, and it's not the end of Chicken Stock, and there's a BDL in Chicken that they're not using, and I know that Fairbanks BDLs are used in Arctic Man, and many different people have used them over the years. It's quite lucrative, so people actually want to cater that event, and I am a former BDL owner, and I've catered events from Fairbanks to Valdez, so it's not, I understand Chicken Stock wants to sell their own alcohol, as does pretty much everybody in the state these days, but I don't necessarily agree that distance or geography is a barrier, and people cater festivals and concerts pretty much, that's the standard way of doing it. So I don't, it's a workable system. Representative Fields, I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the discussion in the committee on how many REPLs there are. I wouldn't support this if it was unlimited or allowed folks with a restaurant in an urban area to have a festival in their front yard when there are dozens of BDL permit holders in a nearby area. But given the extremely limited nature of it and the fact that this is a remote area where, you know, I don't know what the relationship between the BDL holder and chicken is and the chicken stock people, and I would just hate for, you know, what if there's bad blood one year and realistically they can't work out an arrangement. So anyway, because it's a very limited circumstance and because actually it seems like this bill is really just a package of one-offs in some ways, Taku Lanes and Arctic Valley and Eagle Crest, the fair, I'll be supporting this amendment. But I appreciate the committee discussion and the tailoring of the amendment so that it doesn't just throw open the barn doors and negatively impact BDL owners, because I think you've made some good points that we don't want to drive down the value of those permits. And I think that given the remote nature of this festival, it is highly unlikely to negatively impact BDL holders elsewhere.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And I agree with much of what Representative Stute said, that my concerns over this changing REPL's use and narrowing it to, you know, a 10-year history of existence really puts us to the one-off. But as long as we have Ms. McConnell online and we've talked about the year that chicken stock lost its original version of how they were permitted, I'm curious as to whether Ms. McConnell knows, were there other restaurant eating place licenses that year in 2016 were told no for some activity that they had been using it for that they could no longer use it for?
For the record, this is Erica McConnell with the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, not that I am aware of.
Representative Hannon, I have Sarah Oates on the line, who was with Alaska Char, who was previously with what was then the ABC office, so maybe she can shed some light on that, your question, and maybe some other issues. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sarah Oates with Alaska Char. Representative Hannon, to answer your question, there were other permits that had been issued in the past to restaurant eating place licenses that did not meet the necessary qualifications for those permits because they weren't providing banquet or dinner events, and those permits were no longer issued. I can't say if it was in 2016 or if it was 2014 or 2015, but it did occur because of a change of staff who was more closely paying attention to what the statutes very clearly state as being requirements.
Follow up
through the chair. Ms. Oates, can you think of any of the other circumstances that they were? Because this is the only music festival, and we're looking at crafting a very narrow amendment to really solve one circumstance. But, of course, that's frequently the problem with a very narrowly constructed policy. You might not have considered the others. And so I'm wondering if the other REPLs were just blatant disregard to the food wasn't being served, or what other circumstances were they being used in that once the statute was read again became clear they were not appropriately being used?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, there were a couple of other concert events. I can't speak to exactly which they were or which licenses those permits were issued to. Sorry, I don't have access to the database anymore, but under the current proposed definition of music festival, any concert where there's more than one performer would qualify for this permit. And so while your intention is to limit it to just this one chicken stock event, the way that this bill is written would really expand upon it more than anticipated.
Have you been able to see the amendment that's being proposed? Is one of the caveats.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I did look at it. I literally just got off of an airplane And I'm going to another gate. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it does say in the amendment on line 15 that it has to be a festival that has existed for at least 10 years before the application of this permit. And I believe that the maker of the amendment's intention was it couldn't be that a new restaurant eating place license could be used to host a concert this summer if they had not previously done it for 10 years.
Representative Hannon, to the chair, if I may respond to that. If that's the intention, then I think maybe the language could be a little clearer. It doesn't specify that that particular licensee had to be providing the catering for that festival for the preceding 10 years. And again, it's impossible, relatively impossible for the staff to determine whether or not a music festival had been in existence for 10 years or more. Somebody could argue that a particular performer or multiple performers that often perform together, which happens all the time up in Alaska with local bands, had been performing regularly together during that time every year. So I know it maybe seems unlikely, but I've seen a lot of things get pushed beyond the intent over the past 8 years.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Would it make it a little more clear if it said a music festival that has existed in this location for a period of 10 years? Because then you would be able to reference the licenses that have been issued for that area, that particular area.
Representative Stutes, to the chair, I think if you limited it to either that particular licensee or if the intent is really to do this for specific to chicken stock, if you limited it to restaurant eating place licenses that are located in unorganized areas that don't have local governments, that would really limit this to make it a lot more palatable.
Oh, thank you.
So Ms. Oates, what you're saying is if there's some place that's had, Hobo Jim or Hobo John or anyone play every year for a certain weekend, they can call that now a festival retroactively and say, yeah, we've had Hobo Jim here every year. Now we have a music festival. We'd like a REPL music festival license. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then also on this amendment, it says, a festival permit may not be transferred or renewed. And maybe this is a question for Ms. McConnell. Can a permit be transferred? I thought the license can be transferred. A permit, that's just a one-off deal, correct, Ms. McConnell?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So the permit would be issued for that particular event, then that permit is over, and should another event happen, it would need a new permit. So I think the intent of that language, which I believe is in multiple permits, is that once a permit is issued, if your event's on Saturday and your permit is issued to you on Thursday, you can't then give it to someone else on Friday to operate the event on Saturday.
So if I think what the intent is if the business is sold, this privilege, the intent is not to extend it to the buyer, but this is saying the permit can't be transferred. The license would be transferred. Would the new owner then be able to have a music festival permit according to this amendment?
Mr. Chair, my understanding of this amendment is that any REPL could apply for a music festival permit, but the music festival itself would have to have been in existence for at least 10 years, but assuming you have a qualifying festival, let's use Chicken Stock as an example, that they could use a different REPL to get their permit each year. They don't have to stick with the same licensee to serve at their festival every year.
So they could get a Chinese restaurant in Juneau, Canton Bistro could cater the REPL for Chicken Stock, according to this amendment.
Mr. Chair, that is how I read it, yes.
Representative Fields.
I like Ms. Oates' idea of clarifying in the unorganized borough, and I guess I would just ask the maker of the amendment if he would consider a friendly conceptual amendment to ensure that these aren't popping up in urban areas.
Yeah, I would be fine with that.
I guess what we're finding out is even when you try to do something simple, it ends up being complicated because, for example, this says the permit may be sold or not sold or transferred, but permits aren't sold or transferred anyways. Licenses are, and this isn't specific to a particular REPL, i.e. the restaurant chicken, and I guess that kind of reinforces my objection to it. It's a little ambiguous. It's maybe hastily written. I appreciate the intent. I really do. I know that chicken stock is near and dear to many people, and no one wants to see it go away. However, it hasn't gone away, even since they've lost their privilege to their ability to use the REPL incorrectly. So, and maybe Ms. Oates, the events that you cited that had used REPLs that were later stopped from doing so because of improper use of that permit, are they, do you know if they were still functioning, if they're using BDLs, or if they've gone away, or is it, do you even remember?
Mr. Chair, there were a number of events that were taking place that didn't meet the necessary qualifications, and I believe some of the ones either started partnering with the BDL or the restaurant eating place licensee who was obtaining the permits did start providing adequate food.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, I guess I would also ask if the language could be clarified to say licensee or license rather than permit in terms of the transfer, just to make sure that it is consistent REPL stewardship of a given event, which seems to be the intent, and maybe the alleged legal staff just didn't quite pick up on that. I'm not really sure why the word permit is in there instead of license, but that would seem to be another technical fix that would clarify the intent.
I think we want to be able to sell the license or transfer it, but we don't want this privilege of having a REPL music festival without providing a banquet. I mean, we're sort of bending all the rules. And Representative Stutes.
On line 19, how about if we put, through the chair.
Through the chair. Go
Thank
ahead.
Thank you. A music festival permit may not be renewed upon transfer or sale of the REPL. Would that limit it?
I'm not going to wade into the legal language here at this point.
Would that limit it from being issued after the sale of the eating establishment if it said a music festival permit may not be renewed upon transfer or sale of the REPL?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes. So permits are not renewed at all. They're discrete things that get evaluated on a case-by-case basis. So my understanding of the discussion is that there may be an assumption that the REPL that is serving the festival is that they are somehow tied together in perpetuity, and that's not really the case, that the festival can be served by a different REPL at any time. So if you are attempting to create a tie between a particular REPL and a particular festival, I think you would need different language than what is on line 19.
How about if you take out renewed through the chair?
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Stutes.
And put in issued. So say a music festival permit may not be issued upon transfer or sale of the REPL used for the music festival.
May I interrupt at this point? I think I sort of going back to the language of an unorganized area, because that's probably really limited, and I don't know how many restaurants there are in unorganized areas. There's probably a few with a festival going on for more than 10 years. So I'm okay with that, but I don't want to try to craft it on live television. So, can we set this amendment aside briefly? I'm not going to gavel out without dealing with it. Okay. But Representative,
if I could, Mr. Chairman, I think it's more important actually that the focus of this bill was not a music festival permit at all. I'm not going to speak for the sponsor of the bill, but at this point, there are so many questions and everything around this. I'm going to withdraw this amendment, okay, Mr. Chairman, because I think the main focus of the bill was actually had a lot more to do with our state fairs and everything, and I don't want this wrapped around the axle and not advancing all. So.
Okay. And I'm not saying we won't put some of that language in that you're trying to do. I think doing it right now at this very minute. But we may have another chance before too long. Just throwing that out there. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll withdraw the amendment.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
What's next? Member number two, which is mine. I move amendment number two.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Stutes. And I can have my staff present it.
Oh, there you go. For the record, Ashley Straug, staff to Representative Wohl. Amendment number two is intended to make it very clear that we are intending a public ski area to be a place that has skiing and snowboarding, sells lift tickets, and then what we've added here is that it has a permanent public structure to it.
Lieutenant Fields.
Question about the word public. I know it probably sounds nitpicky, but is a public structure one that is used by the public who patronizes a facility, or is it a structure that is owned by the public? So I'm thinking the Arctic Valley Skier has a structure that is used by the public. I don't think it's owned by the public. Is that?
Through the chair, that we would mean a structure that is used by the public. So okay. The intent here is to avoid someone, say, having a shed on their private property and a snow machine and saying, well, I can sell a lift ticket, ride someone up on a snow machine, and then have a structure that's
got it
on private
okay
property.
Thank you.
Our intent was just to more solidly define what a ski area is, and since a real ski area with like a building,
yeah,
not just like an ATCO unit or something, but permanent structure. Yeah. Any other questions? Is your objection still maintained?
I withdraw my objection. I remove my objection, I should say.
Representative Hannon.
So can you walk me through the other two parts of the amendment? Fairs and other events versus an annual fair?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Hannon.
And have you identified yourself for the record? I don't recall.
I think I did. Ashley okay Straug, staff to Representative Wohl. Representative Hannon, the idea here was just to also make it very clear that when we say a fair, we mean an annual fair. And the intent here is to avoid, say, the Tanana Valley State Fair in Fairbanks, which has quite a lot of infrastructure on their fairgrounds that's there year-round, from utilizing their license to operate things outside of the fair time on the grounds. So in other words, the license would be used for the fair.
Follow up?
I don't think I have a follow up.
Yeah, I mean,
you want to talk to, I want to hear Senator Machicki's.
Sure. I mean, basically, this is to define a fair as the activity, it's the actual fair, not like a month later they have a.
I was going to summarize it as saying your distinction here is drawing a difference between the sequence of time, the fair, and the physical location.
Yes. Senator Machicki.
Thank Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Committee. Senator Peter Michicki, District O.
I think there was a question for you.
So my, I guess my question is, if you've had the opportunity to look at Amendment 2, where it is replacing in two locations on page 4 the phrase fairs and other events with an annual fair, and then on line 26 fair with annual fair, and hearing the narrative from the maker of that amendment being that he's looking to the sequence of events, which I know at the Palmer Fair is what, 2 weeks or is it 2.5, versus the infrastructure location, and whether I don't know enough about the original bill and the fair need, whether this still allows it to meet the needs of the fair from your original intent.
Well, the if I may, Mr. Chairman, the executive director of the fair is online, the Alaska State Fair, which is my primary target, and that may be a better question for them. I think that'd be a better question for them.
And but I'll go to Jerome Hertel, but also Representative Hannon, the State Fair is previously using a rec site license, and that ability is grandfathered in this bill. So they won't lose any of the abilities that they had prior. So, Mr. Hertel?
Oh, yes, my name's Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerome Hertel, manager of the Alaska State Fair. This amendment would restrict our ability to develop some of those off-season events and generate revenues for those off-season events that we do have here on the grounds. Currently, we are able to use a special events permit for some of the off-season events. But as you can see, as you know, those special events permits are limited, and we run into a problem every year where we have all different kinds of off-season events. We have over 75 off-season events that happen here on the fairgrounds, and we use up those off-season permits right away. And then we're unable to serve the community as far as offering a location for other off-season events, such as wedding receptions and social events and social gatherings and things of that nature. I guess we would be more in favor of leaving the current language that allows us that ability to provide that service to the community.
Mr. Hertel, my understanding is the fair currently, or was until December, using a rec site license, in which case with a rec site license I thought you could do events there. And maybe I can ask Erica McConnell that same question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, would probably be a good question for Erica McConnell. She could probably describe our situation probably in a little more detail, how our license, how we've operated under those licenses.
Ms. McConnell?
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Erica McConnell with the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. My understanding is that in general, and I would have to do some research to confirm this, but I understand that in general, the fair was using their rec site license to operate a variety of events throughout the year. However, there was an issue with being able to have events on portions of their licensed premises that would accommodate unaccompanied minors, because unaccompanied minors are not permitted on licensed premises. So we worked with the fair to develop an alternating premises system, which is allowed under regulation, that allows the fair to create a schedule on which some of their portions of their licensed premises
are sometimes licensed and sometimes not licensed so that they can use those premises for events that would have unaccompanied minors. So it's my understanding, and Mr. Hertel could correct me if I'm wrong, but that there would not be the need for the fair to use permits any longer, that they would be able, that as they had been doing, would be able to use their license for various events year-round.
So what you're saying is if they use their grandfathered rec site license, they could continue doing what he described as 75 events a year, which sounds like a lot, six a month. That's more than one a week. And he could continue to do that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Hertel, just out of curiosity, 75 events a month, did you ever just consider buying a BDL?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess that would be another question for Director McConnell if we qualify for that. I will, as far as the 75 events a year, I'm not saying that we utilize alcohol service during all those events. Those are just a number of events that we do have on the grounds. I would say perhaps 15 to anywhere from 15 to 20 events are events that we would serve alcohol during.
Okay. Representative Senator Michicki, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I dropped this bill to support an event that all Alaskans enjoy every year for a couple of weeks. And it's an expensive event, and they use the earnings from alcohol to provide programs for children, programs for agriculture. It's a very important event to Alaskans. And I think taking a big step that could potentially negatively impact them at this point with 3 days left in perhaps 4 days, perhaps longer, hopefully only 4 days, Mr. Chairman, is dangerous. I support the Alaska State Fair, and I think every Alaskan does. So I support the first part of this amendment. I don't know if we know enough for the second part of the amendment, and that worries me a little bit, to be frank, Mr. Chairman.
It's my understanding that the grandfathering section alone would keep the fair running as it's been running for the past few decades, or however long they've been using their rec site license. So, I mean, people told me that the actual fair license, standalone license, wasn't needed, but this would be, help future fairs that wanted to be able to sell alcohol during their fairs so they could make more revenue, so they could be more sustainable. As I said again, everybody makes money selling alcohol. The Alaska State Fair has been doing it for a long time. And quite successfully, they hire a lot of national bands costing many hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think they have a pretty good business model. The grandfathering section alone would preserve that. The fair license and on line 17, page 2, would enable future fairs, such as the Tanana Valley State Fair, the Kenai Fair, the other fairs that fulfill the description of fair, would now be able to join that elite club of fairs that can keep their own alcohol revenue. So I like the language. It restricts that to that period of time during which another fair may want to enter the arena and be able to sell alcohol, but it wouldn't be a facility that they could sell alcohol at every week of the year, which that wasn't the intent of the fair section. Representative Rebeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I worry too, and I think I just offer a suggestion. If we want to, in the future, take a look at solutions for chicken, I mean, maybe we could take a look at these specifically later. If there's any question at all about the state fair for this upcoming year, maybe that's an option.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, from what I heard from Ms. McConnell, it doesn't sound like the fair will be impeded at all by having their events. It sounds like they could go on as they have gone on in the past. Is that correct, Ms. McConnell?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
So I think we've satisfied the Alaska State Fair. And I'm getting a thumbs up from Senator Michicki. If you're going to speak, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's fine. I'm at this point, there are quite a few businesses that are depending on the bill as well as the fair. If that's the case and it doesn't impact them, then I'm supportive of it. And I'll just tell you in advance that I'm supportive of the next amendment that I'm not supposed to be talking about right now.
Okay, thank you. I had to look to see what it was.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would withdraw my objection to amendment number two.
Thank you. Thank you, and then with that, we'll move to amendment number three. I move amendment number three.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
And I'll have my staffer, Ashley, explain it.
For the record, Ashley Strauch, staff to Representative Wohl. Amendment number three states that a business can provide entertainment on their premises either from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. or from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. This is a change from the CS. The CS, we opened it from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., so a full 12 hours, whereas originally in statute this was 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. So this amendment would allow a business to choose either the 11 to 7 time frame or the 3 to 11 p.m. time frame in order to offer live entertainment. After the two-year duration of their license, they could, upon renewal, change their designation. But for the duration of that two-year license period, whichever time frame they choose, that would be what they would have.
Representative Stutes.
I'm fully supportive of this amendment. I think it curtails establishments that aren't in the liquor business from becoming the liquor business.
And to reiterate, these are for restaurant eating place licenses. Restaurants that have beer and wine license that have, they're allowed to have music from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. There were some businesses that approached us that had wanted music during lunch. So what this amendment does is if they want to serve during lunch, they can start at 11 a.m., but then they have to stop at 7, that's 8 hours. Or if they want to stick with existing statute, they can start at 3 and go to 11. Same time period, just you can choose earlier or late. Any questions? Representative Stutes.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to withdraw my objection to amendment number 3.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair. I don't want to promote you just yet.
I didn't even notice.
Sorry.
Okay. And that's the last of our amendments, which brings us to the bill itself. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing and hearing none. Wow. Thank you. And thank you for coming in on Saturday and working on this bill. I know it's anytime there's an alcohol bill, it raises a little attention. And we'll probably have another one here in the next little while, next year, and probably get some attention from that one, too. May I have a motion?
I can make one up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move. Let's see, do we have a CS?
There
we go. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 16, version 31-LS0283/0 from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objections, this bill is moved from committee. I'll take a brief at ease to sign the papers. Next up is a very simple bill. Senate Bill 83 by Senator Birch, telecom bill, which I'm learning I don't know anything about. No, just kidding. And so we have amendments. We've heard the bill. Where's my script? What am I supposed to say here? What are we doing? Anyhow, we have a handful of amendments, and are there any questions or comments before we get started here?
Before we go to amendments, is RCA or RCA commissioners or staff online? Or
we have Bob Pickett from the RCA, Stuart Gearing from Department of Law, and Jimmy Jackson from GCI.
Okay. Well, maybe this is a question for Mr. Pickett or Mr. Gearing. So could you speak to the meaning of rates, terms, and conditions of service? For example, is the existence of service a condition of service? This is in Section 7 of the bill, rates, AS42.05.3A1.
This is Commissioner Pickett. I'm going to have Mr. Gearing from the Department of Law take the first shot at it, and I can fill in.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, I believe that was Rep. Fields. This is Stuart Gearing, Department of Law. Terms and conditions of service do include the terms and conditions for the establishment of service. So I think the simple answer to your question is yes. The circumstances under which someone acquires service from a utility is included within the terms and conditions of service.
Follow-up, would that include the preservation of service, i.e., would withdrawal of service be a change in the conditions of service?
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, the general any terms that might affect the discontinuance of service would certainly be a term or condition of service. So yes, if there was, for example, a safety issue or something like that that was contained in a tariff, that would be considered a term and condition of service that would allow disconnection.
Okay. Could you follow up? Could you address the meanings of incumbent local exchange carrier versus competitive local exchange carrier in subsections L and M of Section 7? In other words, does incumbent not include certain carriers, and does competitive likewise exclude certain carriers, or are those terms not exclusive of certain carriers?
Through the chair, Representative Fields. Incumbent refers, is it both incumbent local exchange carrier and competitive local exchange carrier are terms of art in the telecommunications industry. And an incumbent local exchange carrier is sometimes also called an ILEC. And those are typically the carriers which provided service when telephone service was a monopoly service. In other words, prior to essentially from the beginning of the initial offering of telephone service in a particular area. So the incumbent is the first local exchange carrier to the area. Any carrier that comes after that would be a competitive local exchange carrier, sometimes referred to as a CLEC. So those terms are exclusive of one another. I'm obviously an incumbent that's in a market where there's competition is competing, but that does not make them a competitive local exchange carrier.
Okay. Follow up. So are there carriers who provide basic residential telephone service who are not encompassed in Section 7, who are neither incumbent nor competitive?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, that's really a factual question. My initial reaction is no. I think that ILECs and CLECs provide all basic residential local telephone service. Having said that, I would certainly stand to be corrected by somebody in industry who knows that there may be some small segment out there that I'm not aware of. But I believe that is completely that there are only two subsets of local residential local telephone service, incumbent and competitive.
Okay.
And we have Commissioner Pickett and Jimmy Jackson. Maybe we'll start with Commissioner Pickett. Did you hear the question, Commissioner?
I don't know if the question that was raised earlier about the rates.
Can you identify yourself and affiliation before you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. This is Commissioner Bob Pickett with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And I think part of the first question dealt with rates in addition to the quality in terms of service. Was that correct? I believe Representative Fields.
Sorry, what's that, Commissioner Pickett? I didn't understand.
I believe part of your question also dealt with rates.
Correct. Well, I haven't asked that part of the question yet, but I am curious about rates, yes.
He was wanting to know whether ILEX and a CLEX would alone, those two things, cover all the services in its designated study area, right?
And correct, Mr. Chairman, and what I'm really wondering is, do these categories of carriers, incumbent local exchange carriers and competitive local exchange carrier, functionally encompass all carriers?
On the landline side, outside of subject to correction by, you know, perhaps as Mr. Gehring indicated, a couple of cases, wireless has this is Commissioner Bob Pickett again from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Customers have opted to go largely for mobility, various forms of wireless service.
I'm just asking about landlines here.
And so I would agree, again, Commissioner Bob Pickett, with Mr. Gehring on his assessment of it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I've been unmuted. This is Jimmy Jackson. I'm an attorney for GCI and have been working in industry for 40 years or more. Every local exchange carrier is either an incumbent or a competitive carrier. There would not be any local exchange carriers that would be outside the scope of either one or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Follow up, I think, primarily for RCA and for Mr. Gehring. So does Section 7 effectively prohibit a carrier from withdrawing service from an area that's uneconomic to serve?
This is Commissioner Bob Pickett with the Regulatory Commission. As was indicated at the hearing on Wednesday, there's a certificate issue also. And abandonment of service is a certificate type of proceeding. And the only one that I have directly been involved with was with a very small community called Healy Lake several years ago. And that involved the power company, the local exchange carrier, and also the inter-exchange carrier, AT&T. And after the proceeding, the commission declined to allow them to abandon service in that area.
I'm not sure if that, maybe Mr. Gehring, if you want to weigh in, I'm not sure that directly answered my question. Does Section 7, by requiring uniform rates, terms, and conditions of service, prohibit carriers from eliminating service that is uneconomic? Does the language in Section 7 do that?
Through the Chair, Representative Fields, this is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. I would actually say no, and the reason I say that is that the specific provision that prevents the discontinuance, suspension, or abandonment of certificated service is AS4205-261, and that is not, I don't believe, one of the portions of 4205 which is preserved by the language in, just checking, but actually it is. It is preserved in Section 8. So the answer to that would be Section 261, as Commissioner Pickett points out, would prevent the discontinuance, suspension, or abandonment of certificated service.
It would categorically prevent it.
Right. Yeah. So, however, I would say that the language of Section 7 does suggest that if there was, for example, a provision in the tariff that said that service to a particular area could be discontinued, it would have to be done in a way which was the same. The conditions would have to be the same for uniform as the language of this bill says throughout the study area. So it wouldn't be able, the carrier wouldn't be able to, if they did have a reason for discontinuing service, for example, because of safety issues or something like that, that it would be it would have to be done on a uniform basis and couldn't be done sort of selectively or without that. But the exact interaction of AS 4205-261 and the new language in 4205-381L through LM, L&M would, I think, probably be something that, that would end up being subject of a little bit of debate if that happened.
Well, I mean, follow-up. So if y'all are telling me that effectively this serves the function of carrier of last resort, that's very reassuring, and I won't need to offer an amendment on that. I mean, that's the clarification that I'm looking for, but I want to make sure that is clearly your understanding of what the language does.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, the Assistant Secretary and Department of Law, the fact that AS 4205-261 would continue to apply to telecommunications services, telecommunications carriers, would, generally speaking, prevent the carrier from discontinuing service in their certificated area without prior approval. So, yes, that would be that provision would. It's not identical to carrier of last resort, but it would serve the same purpose.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
So Section 7 refers to residential local telephone service. So I guess by not mentioning business, our businesses as in private businesses and schools and other such customers not included in this language presently? Or not encompassed by this language?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields, this is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. Of course, right now, carriers have tariffs which define what their classes of service are, and the RCA's regulations require that that carriers offer residential and business service as separate classes of service. That would go away with this bill. So how basic residential telephone service was defined would be a little bit less clear, but there would be classes of service which would not be covered by Section 7, the subsections L and M. And as you point out, business service or commercial service or something like that would not come within the scope of sections L and M or subsections L and M.
Follow-up, I think I might not have been aware of one of the implications of this language, if I understood you correctly. So you said some of the distinction between different types of service go away, you said, with this bill. Could you explain that?
Well, so through the chair, Representative Fields, Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. So the classes of service that a particular carrier offers are defined right now in their tariff. Under this bill, the carrier would no longer have to have a tariff, which would define its classes of service. So it would be somewhat less clear how this would apply, although I would say that the basic residential local telephone service is, I think, a term of art within the telecommunications industry, and I don't think the meaning of that is particularly unclear. But who would qualify for which class of service would be something that would be up to the carriers to somewhat define, and that would no longer be within the scope of 4205 ability to control.
Okay, follow-up. Could you talk about what are the other classes of service? Are they basic business, commercial, are there others? And what are those? Sounds like the terms of art. I'm not familiar with them.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. It varies somewhat. Carriers offer a number of different kinds of service, but the basic distinction is between residential and business or residential and commercial service.
Follow-up, are business and commercial interchangeable? Terms, that is.
Representative Fields, Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. Again, right now, the carriers have the definitions of their classes of service within their tariffs, so that may or may not be, depending on the carrier, you may have a distinction drawn between different classes of service, and those would be defined. So a particular carrier may have a class of service that they call basic business, and they may have another class of service which is large commercial or something like that, and in that case there would be a distinction. On the other hand, they may have only one or the other, and for those purposes they might use shorthand and refer to both kinds of or one kind of service either way. But that right now, that would be defined by the tariff, what they call specifically what they call it and how you qualify for that service.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting issue. Can I ask another follow-up?
Can I ask one question before we go too far? The word tariff keeps getting bandied around. Can you define that, exactly what that means? I mean, I think of a tariff as like a tax, but you're saying the tariff's going to go away. Is that a line item on a phone bill, and that's how they distinguish between different classes of service? And if that tariff's gone, then I'm sure there is some distinction with service within the industry, even though there's no tariff for it. Can you help us with that? We don't work in telecom. I don't know if you knew that.
This is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. I believe this is Chair Wool that's asking the question.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't identify myself yet.
So for the purposes of public utilities and pipeline carriers, the tariff is the document which establishes all of the rates, terms, and conditions of service that their certificated service is offered under. So that would include, essentially, it's the contract between the carrier and their customer that is out there for everybody to see. It can only, right now, under current law, it can only be revised using certain procedures under AS 4205, and those changes don't take effect until those processes have taken place.
Can I interrupt for one second?
For utility regulation,
Mr. Gehring. So again, in layman's terms, by getting rid of the tariffs as AS 4205, that would, the main thrust is so that the telecoms don't have to submit these large filings with the RCA, and then the RCA doesn't have to look at all these large filings. And I think that was one of the main impetus of the bill. So by getting rid of the tariff, that would be eliminated, right? And I mean, is that the main crux of this legislation?
Rep. Paul Stewart, Gehring, Department of Law. I think that's true. I think that's the sponsor's intention, is to streamline the process. But regardless of whether there's a tariff there or not, there have to be terms and conditions of service and rates that people pay, and there has to be some way for the business to make that known to their customers. So what's really happening is that we're not going to call it a tariff anymore, and it's not going to be filed with the RCA, but that doesn't mean there won't be something that defines that. So in general, in layman's terms, somehow people are going to have a way to find out what it costs and what the rules are. And that thing is just not going to be called a tariff anymore.
So whatever that thing is, will it describe a residential service as separate than a business service or a commercial? Or will they somehow in the industry, they'll still make those distinctions, correct?
That would be my assumption. That I believe their intention is to do things like put that on their website and that sort of thing, but it won't be probably not as formal a legal document as a tariff, which has sort of a, if for want of a better word, there's a certain style to a tariff, and I suspect that carriers are going to migrate away from that to a more plain language style. But my understanding is that they would make that available through websites and possibly through printed material as well.
I do.
Representative Fields.
This discussion of changing, my understanding is changing classes of service and classes of service that are not currently encompassed under Section 7 makes me wonder if the language would better read, for example, Section L, the rates and terms and conditions of service of an incumbent local exchange carrier for respective classes of local telephone service instead of basic residential. Mr. Gehring, is there a way to write that language to make sure that Section 7 protections are provided for business and commercial, which would include, I assume, say, a local school district, while recognizing that those classes, I guess, apparently are fluid under this bill?
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, this is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. I can't speak for the sponsor, but my observation would be that many of the classes of service that you just described are going to be in some locations classes of one or very small classes, and they may be subject to negotiated rates, as opposed to, especially if there was no requirement for RCA approval of special contracts and that sort of thing, those might be the sort of thing that would be negotiated. And so the idea of uniformity, I think, was probably deliberate, although I think you probably ought to ask the sponsor about that, but that's my understanding, is that the intention here was for residential consumers to be protected by uniform rates, but to allow larger customers that may have unique circumstances to have the opportunity to negotiate with the carrier.
Okay, follow-up. So setting aside those who negotiate, which I understand some negotiate favorable rates, school districts, that's what I think we've heard from the industry. So setting aside those who negotiate special rates, would it, in your view, still be advantageous to make sure that this language does, in fact, include the respective classes of service and not merely limited to residential?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I think that's a policy question. I'd defer to Commissioner Pickett on that particular point.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Pickett with the RCA. The commission, I think when we made our report to the legislature back in February, we were looking at what we have actually been doing in reality with these tariff filings. And typically, and since I've been here, outside of perhaps a few isolated cases with line extension policies, they are pretty much just it's a ministerial type action, an informational type filing for the commission. And so if a particular carrier decides it's going to redefine or change, you know, classes of service, typically those have just gone through.
Okay, well, when closing, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just say I have an interest in covering multiple classes of service, with the important caveat that, as I think Ms. O'Connor has pointed out, you wouldn't want to have it be so far-reaching that you would inadvertently preclude, say, a local school district from negotiating more favorable rates. But where rates are uniform, they should be uniform across classes.
Representative Hand.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Gearing, we have not had a Department of Law person online on this bill before, and many of us are new to trying to understand the regulation of telecom. So I'm going to ask sort of a broad question, and I know that it irritates lawyers who don't like hypotheticals. But from your perspective, are there concerns? The bill's been described as streamlining a duplicative tariff filing requirement, and our concern is that we make sure that consumers are not shorted on information or the opportunity to participate in notification about rates. Do you have any concerns from the legal perspective at the Department of Law that this bill leaves consumers in Alaska in a disadvantaged position?
I'm not 100% sure who asked the question, but addressing my response to that individual through the chair, Stuart Gearing, Department of Law. I think my observation would be that to the extent that the telecommunications industry is no longer economically regulated, there's at least an argument to be had that the Department of Law has a consumer protection function. I haven't talked to the consumer protection section about whether or not they believe that this would sort of pass that responsibility back to them. Certainly, there should not be, under Alaska law, a vacuum for consumer protection. So if there are consumer complaints, either the RCA or the Department of Law should be in a position to be able to address those. Having said that, there are, you know, certainly the purpose of having a tariff is, one of the purposes anyway, is to make the terms, you know, the rates, terms and conditions of service clear to the public. And whether it accomplishes that goal or not is subject to a great deal of debate, but that's its purpose. And so eliminating it without necessarily having something sort of to replace it does raise some questions about how consumers will know what they're going to be paying, and whether or not what they're paying is the same thing as what their neighbor is paying or what their competing business is paying and that sort of thing. But I think those are issues that will have to be worked out in practice. If this bill passes, the carriers will have to figure out how they're going to communicate with their customers, and the customers are going to be in a position. Many of them are members of cooperatives and who have access to management through their cooperative boards. And so I think that's something that we'll have to have a sort of a new normal that will be worked out in practice if this bill passes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
And I did try to reach out to someone from RAPA, but they were unavailable yesterday, I think sick. But I would have liked to have heard some, I forget the gentleman's name right now, but Representative Fields.
I did have an amendment drafted on Section 7, but I think based on this discussion, it actually probably needs some editing. So I guess if we're going to go forward with amendments today, I can try to describe what those changes would be, but it might be better to just get it redrafted accordingly. I think it's probably accurate to say there's maybe a little difference of opinion between Department of Law and Ledge Legal, and I get that with different lawyers, but I think it'd probably be a good idea to take Department of Law's perspective back to Ledge Legal and have them redraft.
Representative Rivak.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree. I think we've had a lot of time to look at this bill. I would very much like to see us to come to some kind of resolution.
I would too. I'm not going to pretend I understand much of this. So, and I know everyone else is raising their hand like they understand it 100%. But Representative Tallarico.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the points that was made, and Department of Law just talked about this, about local co-ops and things. And so because of previous experience that I had in a different public service arrangement, I had to go to the Regulatory Commission website and look at tariff thing, because they have tariffs for everything. It's not just telecommunications. For example, municipal solid waste. Every carrier has to apply these tariffs and stuff. I'm just wondering how many people have ever actually gone there to look at the tariff to see what the rate was, or have they been contacted by their co-op or by their carrier or by their solid waste people to let them know what the rates were. I don't know if everyone's ever seen a tariff document, but they put stuff on a docket, they bring it to a hearing, it comes out. I like attorneys just as much as the next guy. It seems to be a reasonably complicated legal document, a tariff document, and of course it's all connected with docket numbers and actions and different things, and sometimes they're held up and sometimes they move forward. So honestly, I just wonder sometimes how much all of the tariff information even provides any of our regular folks. I don't know if everybody else has ever gone there and looked at these documents, but it's a science project to read some of them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I can't say that I have.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. I was having a similar moment, but on the rates, terms, and conditions of service that I am sure are the insert that is, size 6 font that everyone reads and crumples up when they've notified you that there's a change in the rates, terms, and conditions of service, and find the difference between the one that was sent to you 5 years ago. So, I'm feeling more assured without any competency in telecommunications, but assured that this doesn't change how the public will get their information, that we really are cleaning things up into a 21st century environment where very few people's thoughts about whether they're keeping a landline or what the price of their landline is determined by the tariff filing or the rates in terms of service conditions changing. If you're keeping a landline at your property, it's for some other reason. It's because you have bad cell coverage or you want it for a backup in a wildfire situation. So I'm feeling more comfortable with this without an increase of understanding and really.
There are communities that don't have any cell service.
Absolutely.
And we've heard from them, and there's concern that some of these places, although they won't be removed from service, they won't pull the service, There could be poor quality, intermittent service, and I don't know. Does Commissioner Pickett, does the RCA lose any authority over enforcing quality or consistency of service if this bill were to pass? I mean, if a community goes without phone 30% of the time, does the RCA have recourse?
This is Commissioner Bob Pickett with the RCA. Yes, we do have recourse. I mean, we'll still receive complaints, and our staff will continue to try to work, you know, with whoever is making the complaint and the respective carriers. And I think it's important. The carriers need to be reactive and responsive to these complaints, too, because at the end of the day, and this came directly from statements that they made before the RCA in this whole process, really over the last year, that we still have certificate power. And some may say, well, you're not going to pull the trigger on that. But if it's a matter of a consistent pattern of that happening, and as we go into the reform of the Alaska Universal Service Fund, I didn't want to bring that up again, but that's a very important thing, and I anticipate that's going to be the tool that we're going to have to use in the future going forward after the sunset review to address these problems in rural Alaska.
Thank you. Can you address, if the COLR provision goes away, how will, I guess as far as the subsidies go, the COLR, the carrier of last resort, gets funds from AUSF to maintain that COLR, that line, correct?
No, that's not correct. After R18001, effective January 1, again, Commissioner Pickett, of this year, carrier of last resort funding from the AUSF program does not exist. The entire fund has been capped at about half the level it was, and what the remaining support is in essential network services.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that note, Mr. Pickett, so, and if this goes through, and I see that these co-ops are supportive of this, so of course their revenue will go up, correct, for that funding?
Through the chair, Commissioner Pickett, again, when you say their revenue, you're referring to their overall revenue or some specific funding source?
I'm talking about RCA's revenue on from the increased
RCC.
RCC. Oh, sorry, RCC.
Oh, RCCs?
The RCC funds,
yeah.
If through the chair, no.
For the co-ops that would be joining or participating in this that aren't currently participating.
Through the chair, Commissioner Pickett again. The RCC revenues are apportioned amongst the various industry groups. It's an annual process, and it is based on our actual costs, staff costs, other costs, administrative overhead for each of those sectors. And so what will happen in reality is the RCC tax on everybody's bill will actually decrease. The overall amount of money will not increase to the RCA unless activity that particular year after the RCC annual process happens is greater for some reason.
Oh, interesting. Thank you.
Representative Fields.
I have some questions for Ms. O'Connor.
Okay. Yeah, and Representative Birch, Senator Birch was raising his hand too. So if anyone from that section of the room wants to come forward, please do. We haven't heard from you, or we're happy to.
We sat through the meeting last Wednesday and for a couple hours, and
yeah.
I believe you had all your questions answered.
Every question we get answered promotes two more questions that we have. That's what I'm learning about this telecom. I the more I know, the more I know that I don't know. But anyhow.
Chris Birch, District M, Senator from South Anchorage. And I also I am a former member of the Chicken Creek Saloon softball team, having played in Chicken and represented the team up there. So I was paying very close attention to your chicken stock testimony
earlier. There is a saloon.
Yeah. Thank you. Good to be here, and thank you very much for being here on a Saturday afternoon and hearing this very important legislation. I would say this is the second time around. I mean, this horse has been getting beat hard because it went around last year, and actually we have this year we've got full support of all the telecom industry. The regulatory side with the Regulatory Commission has been very supportive. It's a deregulation bill, as you can tell, but nothing in this world simple, but it's a good piece of legislation. It does a lot of good work, and look forward to the committee hearing it and advancing it. And then we'll go through introductions here.
Through the chair, this is Kim Skipper, staff to Senator Birch.
And Chairman, this is Christine O'Connor, Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association. And I'd just like to say thank you for putting so much attention to something that I know is miserably detailed and intricate.
Representative Fields.
Okay. Ms. O'Connor, thanks for providing me some more information on business rates and differential rates in rural and urban areas. So I guess I was curious, why are, and I'm referring to an email you sent me, so I realize most people haven't seen this email. You say most business rates which apply to schools are lower in rural areas than in urban areas. Could you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I was a little surprised myself. I was not expecting that. It makes sense when I step back from a high level. The bulk and sheer numbers of business lines is going to be in the urban areas, and that's where you have probably more complex business systems and more complex business services happening as opposed to the very rural areas. That's one theory I have. As the trade association, I generally don't get involved in rates. It's not a role that a trade association should have, is, you know, being in that realm. So I did ping the members after the hearing, the last hearing, when the question kind of was raised, and that's the information I got back. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of detailed input on that. Okay. I could add that business rates, in our thinking, need less protection than the residential rates, because there is a lot more competition. That's where you see, you know, the higher revenue, big customers, that there is the companies really, you know, are attentive and are competitive in bidding for that, particularly schools with the E-rate program.
Follow up. So is a rural school a big customer in the industry parlance?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, in that each community, the school probably is a large customer. It would depend on perspective for the provider. So if you're a smaller provider and you've got a limited service area of, you know, multiple communities but far from statewide, your school is going to be very large anchor tenant for you. However, there will be competition for that business from the statewide providers as well as the local provider. If you're a statewide or a nearly statewide provider, a small school may not be as large of a customer for you, but you will continue to have a local provider where that customer is very important.
Could we get Commissioner Pickett to weigh in on this? Commissioner Pickett, do you agree? Is it your experience that rates tend to be lower in rural areas? Business rates, that is.
This is Commissioner Pickett. Through the chair, Representative Fields, I probably am not the best one to answer that. As I've indicated before, in my 12 years on the commission, I have yet to see a full-blown rate case.
Maybe Mr. Jackson from GCI can address that question.
Yes, this is Jimmy Jackson through the chair. I'm not very well qualified to answer a question about the rates either. As Ms. O'Connor said, I think we're all a little surprised at the finding and don't know exactly why. And this may be a little bit of an unusual circumstance.
This is the chair, Will. when you said there's more competition in urban areas for businesses, you would think that would drive the rates down, since they're all competing to get the contract for the big facility that has 100 phone lines. But yet, if you're in rural Alaska, where there's one school and one carrier, it's kind of a monopoly. So you'd think that rate would be vulnerable to higher charges, or, you know, I won't say exploitation, but they could charge as much as they want, and the school would have no option since they can't go with another carrier. So it seems counterintuitive to me, too. I don't know if you have any comment to that.
Yes, Chairman Will, Christine O'Connor. A couple points of feedback. When I did ping my members, I got a great response from Mike Garrett, who's CEO of Alaska Power and Tel, who is actually the third largest landline provider in the state. And he said, it's certainly the farthest thing from my mind that we would raise business rates. We want to keep these customers. So that was one I expected. These are important anchor tenants. So while I think there is caution that there may be a window opening to jack those rates up, that is, his quote was, that is certainly the farthest thing from our mind, remembering that those are the tenants that are also purchasing much more in terms of internet services and wireless services. So the landline is, it's still important, but it's a small portion of the business probably being done with those tenants.
So what you're saying, if I'm in a rural community and I have internet and other services and landline's a small portion of it, then I may negotiate, I don't know if there's options of carriers, but because I'm buying a lot of stuff and internet is not regulated, the rates aren't anyways, and broadband and such, so they may add on the landlines as part of the, I know what happens on the residential side. I guess it happens for commercial, and some of the commercial or schools are subsidized as well, and hospitals, is that federally subsidies, and how does that work?
Chairman Wall, Christine O'Connor again. Yes, absolutely. One is that it's common to bundle these services together and to get discounts. You see this across telecommunications. Schools and healthcare are heavily subsidized through the federal government, separate programs under the Universal Service Fund, all of which have strict rules. In the case of schools, confidential bidding RFP procedures to get them the lowest rates possible. So there's just a lot of activity, a lot of pieces in motion on the business side that are all tending to get better deals for the customer.
Thank you. We're joined by Representative Christ Tompkins, and Representative Klayman is here as well, too, which brings me to a question that Representative Christ Tompkins asked me, which was Prince of Wales Island, which I use as an example of a place that has maybe poor quality or intermittent service. Landline only, no cell option. Would this, you know, I guess I'm concerned. I'm concerned about those communities, not as much as the representative is. So I want to make sure that if this bill passes, there's not any kind of license to let quality. I know they won't remove the service. I know that the certificate is a different story, but I want to make sure, like what happened in Kodiak, of loss of service for 47 days isn't a normal occurrence.
Chairman Wall, thank you for the question. That's a great question. I have actually reached out to my members who provide service to Prince of Wales Island over the last couple days, asked them, what do you got going on there? Quite a bit. Got one member that is...
Could you reach him on the phone?
Yeah. He may be listening, one of several of them. There is LTE service going in, which is the fast mobile wireless service that smartphones use, so you have mobile broadband. We've got LTE upgrades going in Craig and Klawock. We've got Alaska Power and Tel has deployed fiber transport throughout most of the island, even into areas where they're not the original incumbent provider. They are moving fiber into... the rest of the island. So there is expanding service. It's not complete yet, but there is a lot of activity happening. As far as the second part of the question, quality of service, an outage which has been mentioned is an aberration, and that is not what we would expect. We actually discussed outage reporting with the Regulatory Commission in a public meeting when they were deliberating on the draft of this bill that we had presented to them. And we were asked specifically, do you expect to continue reporting or outages should this bill pass? And we unanimously and individually, I don't know if people stood up because I was on the phone, but said, yes, we will continue reporting outages. The commission, through its certificate authority, granting the ability, the authorization to start service and hold, they hold the ability to discontinue service. Included in that is that you're not having outages, or if you are, you're reporting. So the commission has the ability, if they think there is negligence or something not happening they're pleased with, they have the authority to open a docket and say, call the carrier in and say, what's going on here? We have concerns. The carrier will then provide information and data, and that docket can proceed. And that all happens under their certificate authority, which is unchanged by this bill.
Okay. I had another question. I forgot it already. I guess the Kohler, I still haven't really followed the money, but is there concern that either the AUSF, from what we hear, has gone, it's capped and going away? It's still here. Okay. It's capped at 10%. Is that correct?
Chairman, well, Christine O'Connor again. The Alaska Universal Service Fund was reformed and changed. Part of that change that was effective January 1st was a cap that reduced the fund between a third and a half. It also eliminated the payments for Carrier of Last Resort, or Kohler. It retained a portion of the fund that is being paid to carriers, which was renamed Essential Network Support, and that is to support intrastate telecommunications services. Now, as part of that reform, the commission will open a docket in 2021 to continue to begin to reform it again. The commission has stated many times that is their goal, that this fund would explicitly fund broadband. So starting this summer, Commissioner Pickett has stated he will begin identifying what data he needs from the providers and in what detail that data needs to be provided to inform that 2021 docket. So I would, if I may, encourage anyone interested in the Alaska Universal Service Fund to participate in that docket at the Regulatory Commission. That is the public process that is teeing off very soon.
So just so I understand this, AUSF has been reformed. The rate was capped at, I had 10, but it's one between a third and a half percent?
Chairman, well, Christine O'Connor again, it was capped at 10%.
Oh, that's right.
Which reduced the actual revenue going to the companies a third to a half.
Got it. Okay, so it's capped at 10%, which reduces the amount of revenue coming in. And it's renamed the Essential Network Support. So since there's no more Kohler designation, these funds, if you're that last carrier, then the funds would, you'd still get help. In other words, you used to get Kohler money through AUSF, is that correct? And now you'd be getting it through ESN?
Yeah. Chairman, well, Christine O'Connor again, at the risk of getting a little complicated here, the old AUSF had multiple segments that it was paying for different functions. There was a portion for Lifeline for low-income consumers. There was a portion for Carrier of Last Resort explicitly. There was the largest portion was to reimburse companies for something called Carrier Common Line Cost. The goal of that support, the end result of that support, without getting too technical, was to lower in-state long-distance rates. It picked up some of the cost, most of the cost, so that our in-state long-distance rates finally became the same as calling out of state. If you remember 10 years ago, you could call Arizona for 3 cents and it cost you 25 cents to call Bethel. Mm-hmm. That is how that problem was fixed. So really the amount that was remaining roughly is that portion that paid for the costs of the in-state long-distance service.
Any questions? What about amendments?
I've got some amendments, Mr. Chairman.
What's that?
I thought you already moved.
No, we haven't.
Haven't done amendments yet.
That was the last bill.
You are ready for amendments?
I guess so, unless there's questions for the bill sponsor or the commissioners or anyone else who's available.
Okay.
I mean, I feel like we've... Yeah, and in my discussions with various people, both in committee and out of committee, I mean, my takeaway is the bill is a good bill and it does good things. So I just want to get that on the record. I do support the intent. I'm just trying to do my due diligence and be cautious when you're doing a telecommunications type bill that deregulates. I don't understand it. I'm not going to lie to you. And if there's something that happens as a result of this that I wasn't aware of, you know, I want to try to prevent that. So, I'm just trying to get as much information as I can. And it was a very short time. I didn't work on this bill for 6 months or over the interim or anything like that. So, that being said, Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. That's where I'm coming from as well. I would move Amendment Number 1, except striking lines 1.
Let's sure. Move it, and then we can talk about it.
I'll move Amendment Number 1.
I object.
And I would like to amend this amendment. I think the discussion on Kohler has been beneficial, and for that reason, I'm not sure what the right process is, but I'd like to move Amendment Number 1, striking lines 1 through 10, which deal with Kohler, so that all that would remain is adjustments to the civil penalty. Mr. Chairman, I think you had a suggestion on an appropriate daily amount.
Yes, I thought that it's $100 currently, and $10,000 seems way too much. And I think Mr. Gehring from Department of Law wanted to speak to this amendment as well. So I'll allow him to do that while I'm looking for my notes.
Chair Wohl, this is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. I had actually spoken with Representative Fields' office and with your staff, and my observation about this, and all I wanted to pass along is that although Ms. O'Connor indicates that her members believe that they will continue to report outages, as it's currently written, there would be no ability for the RCA to require reports of any kind because AS 4205-141A5 is the current mechanism that the commission uses for requiring reports from utilities of all kinds, and telecommunications carriers would be exempted from 4205-141A5 by this bill. So you may have an issue where the commission might not find out about an outage except by reading about it in the newspaper or getting a customer complaint because of that. And so as a result, you may, it may be a little bit more difficult to implement than might be apparent on the face of it.
And follow up. If I could follow up, thanks, Mr. Gehring. And my staff did hand me that during the discussion on Senate Bill 16, so I appreciate you getting it to us. And I think it makes a lot of sense to maintain the requirement that outages are reported. I mean, I appreciate the good intentions of carriers now, but we have no idea. You know, for all we know, some hedge fund from New York City is going to acquire one of our carriers, and they might not be so interested in service on Prince of Wales Island. So, you know, I look at this bill as we're structuring policy to protect consumers and not rely on the goodwill of businesses, which are going to change hands potentially dozens of times by the next time we rewrite the statutes. So, Mr. Gehring, what would be the fix to ensure that outages are still required to be reported?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I guess I hadn't been asked to provide language, so I'm going to suggest conceptually that this section could be the language could be drafted in the section that required that outages be reported within a certain period of time, or that outages be required as specified in regulations to be adopted by the RCA, something to that effect. I don't have specific language for you at this point. The other option, of course, would be to remove AS 4205-141A5 from the exemption so that reporting generally could continue to be required, not just on this subject, but on other subjects that might be necessary to implement the Public Utilities Regulatory Act.
Got hands are going up everywhere. Yeah. Okay.
I just want him to slow down and repeat the citation because he's rattling it off too fast for me to follow him.
Okay. Mr. Gehring, could you repeat that slowly, and then I'll get to the other people who want to speak.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry. I'm trying to respect your time, and apparently I'm actually wasting it rather than saving it. The statutory citation is AS 4205-141A5. And that is currently the statute which allows the RCA to require utilities generally, which currently includes telecommunications carriers, but if this bill passed in its current form would not, it would to file reports with it, both by regulation and on a case-by-case basis.
And I'm assuming that's a section of this bill that I
Well, yes. Chair Wool, I'll direct your attention to the amendment. It's in Section 8, and it says that it exempts except for AS 4205-141-ENF. So, in other words, it's exempt telecommunications. Well, utilities providing telecommunications services are exempt from all of 4205-141-A through D by implication, and ENF remain. So the reporting requirement in A5 would go away if the bill was passed as it's currently written.
Senator Birch has his hand up. Sorry, I'm just used to you as a representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'm concerned about the process. This is basically a culmination of nearly 2 years of work, because it got through most of the body last year. So this is a long-term effort. As you notice, it's fairly complex. Neither you nor the sponsor of these amendments made an effort to reach out to me as a sponsor of this. I that would have been helpful. We, in fact, received 7 amendments at 11:45 today, thanks to the good work of the people on the phone and the hard efforts of the folks that have been here on Wednesday and again here on Saturday. There's been ample opportunity to kind of discuss this, but I'm concerned about, you know, winging it on a Saturday afternoon with 7 amendments that have been out here. And I object to the amendments. I've gone through them, scanned them, and discussed them with the trade folks. I've discussed them with the Regulatory Commission. And I'm just concerned about process. I think when you do this stuff on a Saturday afternoon, you drop 7 amendments, you know, 6 hours, and never share it with the sponsor of the bill, it just seems to me like it's a little upside down. And I am not supportive of this amendment, and I you know, there's clearly improvements that can happen anytime, but you know there needs to be some dialogue, and I certainly would have preferred that as a bill sponsor. I would have preferred if the sponsor of the amendments had come and, you know, maybe corresponded with us sometime in the past 6 months.
I'll let Representative Fields respond to that.
Thanks, Senator Birch. Yeah, I actually wasn't 100% sure if we were going to be offering them today, and honestly I wasn't sure how many I would be offering based on discussion on some of the issues that we've talked about, including Kohler. So the one on Kohler, decided not to offer because I've been reassured that I don't need to. So a lot of this was just me trying to understand complex issues as quickly as possible and kind of having something ready if we had to offer the amendment. So it certainly wasn't my intention to blindside anyone, but actually eliminate as many of these as I could feel comfortable.
I just saw these amendments recently as well, but as far as the process, I mean, you know, we've had, I think, one hearing on this bill.
Two.
Is this our third?
Yep.
Okay, everyone's nodding yes. It doesn't make it any simpler content, you know, and some of us actually want to understand stuff before we just pass it out of committee. You know, call that a bad process, but I don't disagree with that process necessarily. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm looking at amendment number one, and I'm going to speak against amendment number one because I don't think it's to the benefit of any provider to allow their service to go out. I understand it was my community that went without for 47 days, but I think as a basic rule, the public is going to dictate. They're not going to put up with that. And it troubles me to see this, particularly knowing the bill has been vetted fairly thoroughly. I agree, and I understand the fact that it's difficult to understand, and I'm not professing to the fact that I understand it fully. But I think there's some parts of this that, like I said, I just don't think it's to the benefit of the carrier to let the service be without. So anyway, I'm speaking against the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative Fields.
I wanted to ask what you had mentioned you thought there might be a more appropriate daily fine. $100 just seemed meaningless to me. I'm not sure what the right amount is if we are going to have one. You know, people can vote down the amendment if it's the will of the body, but I did want to see if there was a consensus around a better
number. Well, when I heard whatever meeting it was, that $100 a day for a telecommunications company, I thought was almost laughable.
Yeah.
That's what you charge a, you know, hardware store or something. So I, Christine O'Connor, yes.
Chairman Wall, thank you. Christine O'Connor again. The statute with the $100 a day is in 571, I believe. It applies to all utilities, not just telecom. And because the bill is telecom specific, we didn't try to go there because that's going to involve more than just our group. It is outdated. $100 a day, I don't know how old that must be that someone thought it was significant. We don't dispute that. Our caution would be that it would be better to have a separate update over there and look at how it would apply to all utilities, since that's how the statute is structured today.
Okay. Well, I guess my view would be there are going to be economic conditions under which carriers are monopolies in Alaska due to geography. And unfortunately, the case in my colleague's district does seem to indicate that sometimes there's not an economic imperative to fix an outage quickly. So I guess I'm going to continue to offer the amendment, and obviously it's people's prerogative to vote their conscience.
If I were to adjust it, I'd say $1,000 a day.
I'd consider that friendly.
You know, is something that I don't know when this was written, in 1960 or something like that. But and you know, but a 10,000 is exorbitant, and 100 is too little.
Mr. Chair, for the sake of time, I'm going to call for the question.
I can take a brief at ease.
Mr. Chairman, can I just ask, does the record reflect now that I've accepted that, I think, amendment to the amendment, so it would be $1,000 daily fine. Just want to make sure that's on the record.
Representative Hannon.
I want to ask Commissioner Pickett a question about these fines.
Okay.
Commissioner Pickett, this is Representative Hannon through the chair. It's my understanding that currently the fines for outages and notification are currently in regulation. Does the commission have the ability to adjust those regulation, those penalties via regulation, or is it only done via statute?
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Pickett, Representative Hannon. We have not addressed that directly, primarily because we have some fairly significant issues coming down with potential reform of the Rail Belt electric utilities, and that report will be going to the legislature next week. And part of that are our recommendations with mandatory reliability standards. And so we're trying to figure out the best vehicle forward for that, and you folks will be playing a big role in that. So we've sort of left the whole fines and penalty issue off to the side for the time being.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Let me clarify and try and simplify for those of us who this is outside our day jobs. Your report will indicate a penalty change for utilities addressed across a number of sectors of regulated utilities, and you can do that without a statutory change.
I'm going to have Mr. Gehring jump in at this point. This is Commissioner Pickett again through the chair. Ms. Stewart, would you care to opine on that?
So I believe that was Representative Hannon through the chair. This is Stewart Gehring, Department of Law. The specific statute that we're dealing with here is AS 4205-571A, which does provide for a maximum penalty of $100 per violation. and that statute does date back, I believe, to 1970. I will point out, however, that AS 4205-581 provides that each violation of any order, decision, regulation, or written requirement of the commission is a separate and distinct offense. So there's an argument that in the case of an outage, that every customer who was out of service for a particular day would be a separate violation, and so you might actually have 100 times, however many customers there were, times the number of days. But as far as the question about changing that, the maximum penalty of $100 per violation is in statute, and that would not be able to be increased by regulation, although it could be it could be lowered certainly by regulation, or the what constitutes a separate violation could be defined by regulation, but the maximum could not be increased except by a statutory amendment.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I have just a quick follow-up, probably for Mr. Pickett. Could you give me an idea of what other utilities might be affected?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, you're referring specifically to the penalties and the statute?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
It could be any utility that's subject to our jurisdiction. And we regulate electric utilities. We regulate waste providers, natural gas, local distribution companies.
Mr. Gehring, this is Zach Fields. Is the amendment drafted to change the penalties for all those utilities? I guess just reading it looks to me like it's limited to telecom companies, but I might be misunderstanding that.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, as it stands right now, your amendment number one to section 8 would only apply to would not apply to telecommunications carriers generally. It would only apply to a telecommunications carrier that had been designated as a carrier of last resort to provide service in a particular area. So it wouldn't even, the penalty wouldn't even be potentially applicable to every telecommunications carrier with an outage. It would only be a caller that had an outage as it's drafted.
Thanks. So I'm actually not concerned about not providing coverage in an economically competitive area where there clearly will be economic reasons for a carrier to provide that service. I'm really only concerned in a monopolistic environment where there's just potentially not that economic incentive. So thanks for clarifying
that. And let us point out, it says a penalty up to.
Right.
So it doesn't make it mandatory. So, it's not demanding $1,000. Commissioner Pickett, the incident that brought this, I think, up was the Kodiak Island situation where service was lost for 47 days. Was that provider fined $4,700? Do you know?
Chair Wohl, no. No proceeding had been started to initiate a $4,700 fine against that carrier at this point. Staff had not brought forth any recommendation towards that end yet. Doesn't mean that it won't happen, but to this point in time, it has not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wohl?
Yes.
I guess all I'd say in closing is you're right. What brought this amendment to mind was our discussion about the $100 fine, the issue on Kodiak, and the fact there's not a meaningful penalty. Thank you.
So where are we at now?
We can vote on the amendment to
yeah.
the amendment.
Yeah. Let's Representative Tallarico.
Mr. Chairman, this is a daily fine, monthly, yearly, annual?
Thank you.
I'm not sure that's defined there in the amendment. So
it's a
Mr. Taylor, if I might, through the chair, the intention was to amend the maximum daily fine consistent with our previous conversation in this committee, and I hope that Legal Eagle has followed
that.
By looking at this, it doesn't look like that's the case, but can Mr. Gehring or...
through the chair, Representative Tallarico, this is Stuart Gehring, Department of Law. As it's currently drafted, it appears to be a single penalty per failure to implement repairs. So for each failure to implement repairs, you could have up to a penalty of $10,000. So for a single event, whether it lasted one day or 47 days or 365 days, it would be a single $10,000 maximum single of $10,000.
Getting clearer by the minute. So Kodiak Island could have, the provider there could have been fined $100 for 47 days of no service is what it sounds like. So no wonder they didn't. Go ahead.
This is Stuart Garing, Department of Law. I guess that's the clarification I guess I didn't make very clearly earlier. Each customer potentially could be considered a separate act or omission. And so you could actually potentially have a proposed civil penalty of up to 47 days times the number of customers who were out of service times up to $100. So the cap would not be $4,700. It would be $4,700 times the number of customers who did not have service.
Right. Hmm. Well, it doesn't say per day, so it's 100 times the number of customers, I think. Ms. O'Connor.
In the current statute, it does, in the statute which is not being amended, it does actually say per day.
Right. So I guess we're amending the wrong statute a little bit. Okay, Ms. O'Connor.
Thank you, Chairman Wolk. Christine O'Connor again. I may have misunderstood, Rep. Fields, actually, that your amendment, you struck lines 1 through 11, which are the ones that allow designation of Kohler. So the penalties would apply to, there would be no more carrier of last resort.
Yeah, I think actually with that clarification, which we did not have at a previous meeting, I'm going to withdraw this amendment because it is not actually $100 per day and is more meaningful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Fields.
I'm going to move amendment number 2.
Object.
Object.
So I think it was in the discussion with, let's see, one of the RCA commissioners and staff perhaps. As I recall, there was a discussion about what one could argue is a lack of transparency with respect to subsidies that are then reinvested in infrastructure. I would see this amendment as an insurance amendment. So if telecommunications utilities do in fact realize savings or increase profitability related to passages of this bill, those would be reinvested in infrastructure. So under this bill, companies could in fact earn more money, but we would have a degree of transparency through the commission to ensure that those some portion of those additional earnings are reinvested in infrastructure.
Ms. O'Connor, do you have an opinion on this?
Thank you, Chairman Wolk. I do. Christine O'Connor. If I may, I would like to clarify that the RCA has complete authority to require reporting around the Alaska Universal Service Fund. My members are in compliance with every requirement that the RCA has instituted and, in fact, must be in compliance to continue receiving those funds. We will be participating in discussions this summer with the Commission on the changes they want to see to create the data they need going forward on the AUSF. So I don't agree that there is a lack of transparency. As far as the specific amendment, this would be a very cumbersome attempt. Telecommunications companies are not cost-regulated companies anymore. Not, you know, an electric utility may come in. They do come in routinely and show all their costs in intricate detail. Telecommunications companies have not done that for probably 15 years routinely, and we don't do it at all for at least 10 years. So the processes are not in place to do this at the commission or with industry. My concern would be that this would divert resources from my members and from the commission that would much better be used looking at the AUSF, looking at other issues. Thank you.
Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Madam Secretary, you get to speak.
Representative Reback?
No.
Representative Hannon?
No.
No.
Representative Clarissa?
No.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Wolf?
No. With a vote of 6 nays and 1 yay, the amendment number 2 fails to pass.
I'm not going to offer amendment 3. I will move amendment number 4.
Okay. And I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Amendment number 4 deletes the material that eliminates municipal authority. I just have a fundamental problem with the state legislature taking away local authority that currently exists. I think there's strong language in our Constitution related to local authority, and support neither unfunded mandates nor the state government taking away local authority. And that's the purpose of this amendment.
I'm going to object.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
I guess I need to hear from Commissioner Pickett as to the current circumstances that there are municipals who regulate long-distance telephone companies within their municipality. What problems could you foresee if you provided long-distance service across, say, the 5 or 6 different municipalities, and one chose to participate in internal regulations within its municipal boundaries, but not in your entire service area?
Through the chair, I would like to ask, I think that this would be kind of a problematic situation. In fact, I'm trying to think with local municipally owned telephone utilities. Ketchikan, I believe, is the only one, and I would turn to Ms. O'Connor for comments on that.
Chairman Wall, Christine O'Connor again. Yes, we have one municipally owned local exchange carrier, Ketchikan Public Utilities, and they are overseen by their city council. This section is a little different. Currently, municipalities do not regulate long-distance carriers, and they don't regulate local exchange carriers, except in the case where the municipality is a telephone company.
Representative Fields.
Well, as we're having this discussion, once again, I'm saying that the alleged legal draft is not exactly in line with my intent. Actually, all I wanted to do was strike the additional language, or a local exchange carrier. It's not my intent to mess around with longstanding statutes about regulating long-distance carriers. The intent here is if you have a local carrier in a local area, and let's say we screwed up and failed to foresee something under this bill where local consumer protection is needed, I would not want to preempt that. I recognize that, I'm not advocating for changing longstanding statute related to local regulation of long-distance carriers. So I wish this had been drafted differently, but actually all I want to strike on line 8 is, or a local exchange carrier, to preserve current statute with respect to municipal preemption.
Representative Stutes.
I'd like to hear what kind of impact that would have from Ms. O'Connor, if possible.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, Christine O'Connor again. It would be a similar problem if municipalities began regulating the local landline carriers, because several are very large. United Utilities has 76 communities across the state, so you can kind of imagine the patchwork of regulations that could develop. Alaska Communications has almost 50 villages. So that would be our concern if a local municipality wanted to regulate telecom. It's my understanding that that is basically preempted right now, and would continue to be, because the Regulatory Commission has authority through the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. This might be it is a bit complex even for me. Jimmy Jackson is on the line, and he's experienced in the legal nuances if you need more clarification.
Mr. Jackson?
Yes, this is Jimmy Jackson through the chair. I don't have a lot to add to what Ms. O'Connor said or what Chairman Pickett said. There's no municipal regulation of telecommunications at this time. The this provision would put local carriers on the same footing as long-distance carriers as barring it, but it would really just maintain the status quo because there's no regulation of by the municipalities now. But as Ms. O'Connor said, United Utilities, which is owned by GCI, serves a very large number of municipalities, and it would just be a nightmare if each of them independently tried to regulate within their little area.
Well, Mr. Representative Fields.
I guess I would just say if they're already preempted, then why is the industry attempting to add this language? And finally, you know, this is currently a regulated industry that is subsidized, and we are substantially deregulating it. And, you know, I hope we're making the right decision, but if we aren't, I think local governments should have the ability to step in and preserve local coverage that might otherwise be eliminated through deregulation. And that's the reason I think we should maintain local authority, at least to the limited extent that it exists now.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the idea of, because I'm a local government guy, and I like local government control, although I would say local government doesn't regulate the solid waste industry either. They can if they own it. If it's municipally owned, they get to control it. If the municipality doesn't own it, then they don't get to do that. And a lot of that, I think, just has to do with cross-boundary issues. We talked about that a lot when we were talking about an Uber bill, about when you go from one municipality to another, or you go from a municipality into non-organized area back into an organized area. And I know that the carrier that I'm under in my area stretches down into another borough, does go, and now is going through unorganized area and is planning on going through more unorganized area. And I really do think that from a municipal standpoint, it would be, if we want to eliminate paperwork and different things and stuff for these people, if they're in two or three different municipalities in an unorganized area, we're going to have municipal restrictions plus whatever it is that we do and everything. And I do appreciate the local control, but I think it would be much easier if it was exempt from the municipal, just because of our geography doesn't allow for the, you know, and all of these different government bodies. That might be really difficult. I don't know for sure, but I think it might be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Further comments? I too balk at what the city councils would be dealing with if knowing what we're dealing with right here.
Good point.
I don't know.
And then they're setting rates.
North Pole City Council, I'm no offense, but anyhow, I will, the objection maintained?
My objection is maintained.
Okay. Madam Secretary.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Reback?
No.
Representative Hannon?
No.
Representative Speaks?
No.
Representative Tallarico?
No.
Representative
Wolf? No. Representative Wolf? No. 1 yay, 6 nays. With a vote of 1 yay and 6 nays, Amendment number 4 fails to pass. Brings us to Amendment number 5.
I am not going to move Amendment number 5 this time. I appreciate the discussion with the RCA and with Ms. O'Connor in terms of the different classes of business. And I'm also not going to move Amendment number 6 related to Kohler based on the further discussion we've had in Section 7 of the bill.
Thank you. We have Amendment number 7 in front of us.
Can we take a brief at ease?
We can take a brief at ease. I'd like to call House Labor and Commerce back to order. We left off at Amendment number 7. Representative Fields.
I'll move Amendment number 7.
I'll object.
So Amendment number 7 would preserve the filing of tariffs and preserve the prohibition on discrimination amongst ratepayers. I think there are actually a couple of different ways that you could reach the goals of this amendment, and one of those would be in the new in the amended Section 7 of the bill, again, in sections L and M, which we discussed extensively, it says the rates and terms and conditions of service of an incumbent local exchange carrier for basic residential. So very helpful discussion. I feel like it's hard to identify perfect language to outline respective classes of service for residential and commercial without precluding the ability of a local school in a rural area to negotiate a better rate than the uniform rates. So in the absence of the ability to, in my mind, perfect Section 7, and I do appreciate the feedback on that section, I think I'm going to move Amendment 7 to ensure that there is some protection for consumers. And maybe it's not the perfect fix. I would probably, for me, a preferable way to do it would be to get ideal language on Section 7. But since I haven't been able to identify that ideal language in consultation with the industry and with RCA and Department of Law, Amendment 7 is my next best option. So there you go.
I'm still not a Representative Stutes.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to ask to hear what Ms. O'Connor's.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at the amendment and hearing your description. I'm still not exactly sure what it does, because I don't have this language unless sure. It's in here, and I just didn't. 4205361.
I can make an effort to explain. Okay. I think, and again, complicated stuff, so I might be wrong, but, you know, I think Section 7 of the bill does provide some pretty good consumer protections for residential telephone service, and I think elimination of COLR, insertion of Section 7, in my mind, is adequate in terms of consumer protection for residential. I remain concerned about consumer protection for commercial, including school districts. There was a way to tweak Section 7 to provide those consumer protections for commercial. That, to me, would be preferable than to Amendment 7. But in my own inability to perfect Section 7, I guess I'm offering Amendment number 7 to provide, in an attempt to provide those protections for commercial carriers, which include school districts. So is that... Does that make more sense?
Yeah, I understand the intent. I just don't know what all these statute references are. So, but we also have Mr. Gary on the line, who I believe wanted to speak to this amendment.
Chair Wolf, this is Stuart Gary, Department of Law. My observations on this to Representative Fields were that, and I think probably as a matter of background, as we address first the lines 2 and 3 of Amendment Number 7, AS 4205-361, it's titled Tariffs, Contracts, Filing, and Public Inspection. And what that does is requires that utilities, currently including telecommunications utilities, have to have on file a complete tariff. So basically everything that they offer to their customers and the terms, the rates and terms and conditions of service for those service offerings are in a public document that's on file with the RCA, and in order to change that, there has to be a filing. So this amendment would put that would maintain that requirement that currently exists. So my observation to Representative Fields that is that in order for that to be a truly meaningful consumer protection, you'd also really have to add back in AS 4205-371, which is the statutory requirement that a utility adhere to its tariff. Because if you publish something, but then you don't have to follow it, it doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. So perhaps it would be closer to his intention to include on line 3 of the amendment AS 4205-361 and 4205-371, which would ensure that whatever tariff was on file with the RCA would be the one that would be actually binding on the utility.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring, and just for committee members wondering why is one lawyer saying this amendment is drafted differently than it should be. Sandin Fisher with Ledge Legal drafted these. Stuart Gehring with Department of Law is providing some suggestions and feedback, and I think just because of the late nature of a complicated bill, we're kind of getting them simultaneously. So thank you, Mr. Gehring, for that suggestion.
Right. And So as to lines 4 and 5, a similar observation, and just to, again, for the background, since Chair Wohl asked what these statutes actually refer to, AS 4205-391 is titled Discrimination in Rates, and it's a very long section, but it basically prohibits utilities from charging rates which discriminate, which actually the language is, grants an unreasonable preference or advantage to any customer or subject a customer to an unreasonable prejudice or disadvantage. So for practical purposes, AS 4205-391 requires that all customers that are similarly situated be treated substantially alike.
And
so that's the background of 391. 411 is the procedural section that describes how a utility provides updates or revisions to its tariff. And the observation that I made to Representative Fields about this particular section is that it's probably not his intention to include all of Section 411. And the reason that I say that is that Section 411C says that the Commission, upon complaint or upon its own motion, without notice, may initiate an investigation of the reasonableness and lawfulness of the change. And that would seemingly be at odds with the purposes of the bill to deregulate the telecommunications industry. So that's just an observation that 411C may go actually farther. By putting 411C back in, may actually go farther than Representative Fields intended. He can certainly speak to that, but that's what it appears, that appears to be beyond his intention.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Gehring. So, yeah, I got this feedback from Mr. Gehring literally during this meeting, so we just haven't had a chance to go back to Ledge Legal and try to kind of get the lawyers on the same page. I guess at this time, though, if I might, Mr. Chairman, I would ask Ms. O'Connor, going back to Section 7 of the bill, do you see a way to write, to include respective classes of service in a way that the language is clear, that it's not making all classes of service have the same rate? Kind of following up on the email that you sent me.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, or Christine O'Connor, I really do not. And I neglected to mention something earlier that might provide a little context. Another thing that's happening, particularly in the business segment of the market, is these services are migrating to VoIP, or voice over IP service, which is completely unregulated because it's on the internet. So while we're talking about landline business service, which still is important, the trend, it's a land rush over to VoIP. So trying to preserve any type of, you know, uniform or regulatory construct over them, I think it would be very intricate and burdensome, and it would actually inhibit companies being able to pursue those contracts, do special deals, respond to customer needs if we had to keep everything uniform.
Thanks. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I might just suggest that in the event that the committee decides to adopt Amendment Number 7, I would just suggest that in the realm of technical and conforming amendments, we get Mr. Gehring and Mr. Fisher together to make sure the amendment is written correctly to identify the issues Mr. Gehring raised.
I just want to comment. I too have, it came up in one of our meetings that residential is mentioned in Section 7, but as was stated earlier, by removal of the tariff, which is also brings up part of your amendment requiring a tariff, I thought the purpose of the bill was to not have a tariff. So if the bill is to remove a tariff and then this amendment requires a tariff filing, then I didn't know how that works. But if there's no tariff, then there's no distinction between residential and other types of service. But they do mention residential in the bill. So I'm wondering how you reconcile that. And I'm also curious. I do want to also protect businesses or non-residential. I'm told that that's not really an issue, but I'm concerned about it too. If there's any way to incorporate that without using tariff requirements, if you understand my question.
Chairman Wohl, yes, Christine O'Connor again. A little more context around what this actual situation is with business rates. Right now, 90% of Alaskans live in areas where the companies have been able to change these rates without permission for over a decade. That's why there have been no rate case filings to review, is because the regulations have been changed in response to the changes to industry, in response to the 1996 Federal Telecom Act, to give, we already have the freedom to do this in virtually every area, and there have not been problems. So it's already happened. We're doing a paper shuffle to record it with the commission. There are literally thousands of pages of these tariffs, thousands. One company alone has over 1,000 that right now must be maintained in detail, literally down to the symbol and the dot level. One company did a web services survey to see how many people are going to the tariff posted on their website, 0.005%. We discussed it in industry, and we think that's just each other going to look at each other's website. So I recognize the concern. I am a small business owner myself. I'm from a rural area myself. But this has already been the situation for virtually all of Alaska, and there has not been a problem. And in fact, you know, rates are able to be changed. Services are able to be changed today with just notification. We're saying, let us continue this successful market practice without the paper going back and forth. Chairman Wohl, also cooperatives, which are about half of the providers in the state, they're not even required to file the paperwork back and forth. They just make the changes in response to their customers.
And I've heard similar concerns from the RCA of not only do the utilities have to file them, the RCA has to deal with them. You mentioned voice over internet protocol, or VoIP as you called it. So does that mean, I know what it means, but in practice, does that work out? So if I'm a building, if I'm a business, and I have internet coming to my building, and I also have a landline, say, it's possible that my landline, if I make a phone call from my phone, and I think this is what's going on in my house in Fairbanks over the last few years, I changed service. I have a landline, quote landline, but it actually goes over my internet cable, because if my internet box goes out, my phone goes out. So therefore, I'm not even really, even though I think I have a landline, and I used to have and I still have the actual cable, since I'm not using it, I'm not even a landline customer anymore. Is that correct?
Chairman Wohl, Christine O'Connor again. Landline is largely a regulatory construct these days, and it brings with it these regulations. It brings with it federal support funds, well, not directly anymore, but the technology underneath could be internet, like you're describing. It could still be a copper wire. That alone does not make it a landline or not a landline.
So with the example that I gave you, I get a phone bill, I'll still be billed, and certain fees will be affiliated with my landline, even though it may come over a fiber optic cable and not my traditional phone line, and hence it's coming over the internet, so to speak. But regulatorily, I'm treated as a landline. But talking about businesses, you said a lot of them have switched to VoIP. But if they have a landline in their offices, it's still treated like a landline. Is that correct?
Chairman Wohl, Christine O'Connor, it depends on what they purchased from their provider. You can go online and order up a VoIP service that is from somewhere, who knows, on the internet, and have business phone service. You can go to your local provider in Alaska, which we hope you do, and purchase a business service, either a VoIP, which is coming over internet, or a traditional landline. It just depends on what you purchased. Depending on what that is, you'll see a different suite of the fees, taxes, surcharges on your bill.
Thank you. Representative Fields, are we on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I share your concerns over the lack of protections for businesses, and we'll continue to offer the amendment.
And I will maintain my objection.
Madam Secretary.
Representative Suri.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Reba.
No.
Representative Hannon.
No.
Representative Stu.
No.
Representative Tallarico.
No.
Representative Wall.
No.
One yay, six nays.
With a vote of one yay and six nays, amendment number 7 fails to pass. Representative Fields, are we done with amendments?
I think that's all of them.
I think that's it. I think we've talked this bill through quite a ways. I have an amendment. It hasn't been drafted yet. I would like to get to it tomorrow briefly at 4 o'clock, Alaska Standard Time. I realize it's Mother's Day. I'm sorry to the mothers in the room, especially those that live in Juneau. But it will be a brief meeting at 4 o'clock. I hope you all can attend. Before I do that, I'm going to mention that I have an amendment deadline for HB 24 Monday at noon to get that out of the way. And I'm going to recess to the call of the Senator Birch.
Thank you, Chairman Wall. I just want to take this opportunity to thank the entire committee and yourself for hearing the bill and taking the time this late in the session and certainly over the weekend. I know it's happy Mother's Day to the mothers in the room, and thanks again for taking the time here on a Saturday afternoon to hear the bill. And I very much appreciate the dialogue and the discussion in the course of this amendment process.
Thank you, Senator. And I'd like to thank the people that called in today and are being on the line for almost 3 hours now. So it's 5:44, and I'm going to adjourn to the call of the chair.
Call your mothers tomorrow.
He did earlier.
Okay. As long as that's clear.
Just pick that one.